Good morning, everybody. Welcome to our McGill session on CHR Foundation Scheme. As you know, this session would be available to watch through internet, so this is information really for the people who is on internet. Okay, my name is Olga Nyberger. I am Director of Grants and Agreements Office of Sponsored Research. I would like just to introduce you that today we will have our speakers. It's Jen O'Donoghue from CHR Executive Director Reform Implementation Program, as well would be Dr. Robin Tumblin, James McGill Professor from Department of Medicine and Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics. As well, you know, she is a scientific director of CHR Institute of Health Services and Policy Research. She should join us shortly. As well, we have here Paul Alasco, professor from Department of Biology, associate member of Goodman Cancer Research Center, and as well a scientific director of CHR Institute on Genetics. Paul will be also available to answer your questions. I would like just to mention also that, as you know, in our Office of Sponsored Research, it's Maureen Donato, who is a grants officer for biomedical portfolio, specifically for CHR. But going forward, it would be Melissa Lee, grants officer. So going forward, all the questions, please communicate with Melissa. During the presentation, please, you could ask our speakers questions anytime, as well as you have time by the end of the session to ask additional questions. Only I would ask you, please turn on your microphone when you ask a question, because this is a registry, and so it would be better to that other people hear your questions, and better for recording purposes. For those people who is watching us through internet during session, you could send questions to maureendonato@mcgill.ca, and Maureen will collect those questions, and our speakers will answer your questions. Also, I would like to indicate that it's very important for people who is in this room, please put your name on our attendance list. This is, we will follow up with you, specifically with McGill researchers, to provide you additional tips and guidance on McGill internal processes with applications. So that's it. So I welcome to our first speaker, Jen from CHR.
So thanks so much for having me here. Hopefully we can be as interactive as possible, and I think the value in some of these sessions is to actually get questions and answers going. So we have a lot of slides, but as I go through the slides, please feel free to lift up your hand or send an email in if you do have a question. And I'm actually going to rely on Paul to answer some of the questions as well, so we'll go back and forth. Just to get a sense of who's in the room, how many of you attended the town hall in December? A few, but not all. Okay. How many are planning to apply to the first foundation scheme and have already started your registration? So most of you, okay. How many people have funding, current CHR funding today? And new investigators? A few. Okay. So it just gives me a better sense of the kinds of questions that you might ask. So what we're going to do today is really focus on stage one of foundation scheme. I'm going to provide a little bit of background and context. It is similar to the background that I provided in December when I was here, but we'll go through it again, especially because some of you weren't there. Then we're going to go through the stage one application requirements, focusing on the caliber of the applicant. I will talk a little bit about stage two, the quality of the program, more because I know there's lots of interest about budget information and how that will look in the application, so I'll cover a little bit of that. And it says questions and answers at the end, but certainly as we go through, please feel free to ask any questions. And I noticed Robin just joined us, so she's at the back of the room, Robin Tumblin. You were introduced, but you weren't in the room when you were introduced. So foundation scheme, and this has been available on our website for quite a long time now. It's designed to contribute to a sustainable foundation of health research leaders. It's expected to support a broad base across career stages, areas, and disciplines relevant to health. So it crosses the entire mandate of CIHR and all career stages. We're trying to develop and maintain Canadian capacity. We're trying to provide flexibility to pursue new innovative lines of inquiry. And we want to contribute to the creation and use of health knowledge, which is part of the mandate of CIHR. As everybody knows, foundation scheme will only be once a year. We have the cycle for this year. The cycle will change a little bit for next year because we did provide a very early registration. The dates for next year's competition will come out in the near future. So the dates for this year's competition registration deadline is June 23rd. We've been monitoring registrations. There are about 800 that are in progress right now, but I think we've only had 42 actually submitted. I do encourage you to submit prior to the deadline if you are able to, because it does give us information for planning purposes. So if you are, I don't think the registration is too complicated. If you are able to complete that prior to the 8 o'clock deadline or whatever it is, the night before, where most people seem to do it, that would be great. The application stage one deadline is September 15th. Once we receive the registrations and that date closes, we will do a validation of who we received registrations from. An email will go out with a link to the application once it's available. And we're hoping to make that process fairly quick, but it'll depend on the number of registrations we have. Decision date for stage one, December 1st. Application deadline for stage two, February 5th. And our funding start date, July 1st, which is a change from the last time I was here. It's 3 months earlier than it was in December. We did change that based on feedback from the research community. We do have application requirements on the website for stage one, stage two, as well as a CV. Hopefully most people did see the alert recently that actually had the CV link there. And we'll talk a bit more about the CV as I go through. So the competition process, this should be familiar to most of you if you've looked at any of the material that's available. Three stages of review. Stage one is about the caliber. Applicants will be asked to submit the application. It will be assigned to five reviewers. Each reviewer will get somewhere between, we're still debating the numbers, but somewhere between 10 and 15 applications. They will be asked to do their review, submit it to CIHR. Applications that are competitive will be asked to submit a stage two application. Again, each application going to five reviewers. Those applications that are ranked high and where all reviewers agree that they're ranked high will get funded. Those applications that are ranked high and where there's some discrepancy between reviewers will go to stage three for the committee discussion. And the applications that are ranked lower won't proceed any further. Applicants who do not proceed past stage two will be notified as part of the stage two decision. So they will be aware of that. Yeah.
How much of the material that will be judged in the stage two component will have to be submitted as part of the main application, the stage one component?
Very limited amount, and I'll go through that. So this is a really complicated slide. We are putting together specific training material that will break this information down in more detail, and that'll be available as the application opens at the end of the month. But basically, we're looking at a structured application. So reviewers are looking at the structured application. They have structured criteria. They're asked to rate using right now, well, we're using A, B, C, D, and E, but we have been told through some of our pilots that some of our reviewers are making judgments on A, B, C, D, and E because of how you grade in the institution environment. So we're looking at whether or not we change that for the first pilot. So more to come on that, but there will be a rating scale that has five different levels with a language ladder. So reviewers rate each of the criterion. As they're rating online, it creates a ranking list. So after they finish each application, it gets ranked in a list. If they don't like the ranking, they can go back and change the criterion, but it's a very interactive process to get to a ranked list of applications. So remember, every reviewer, 15 to 20 applications, every application, five reviewers. Once they've done that, they submit it to CIHR. It then becomes available for online discussion. The discussion period will be about 72 hours. Reviewers will be asked to discuss when there's discrepancies in reviews. We have tested the technology through some of our pilots. So far, the reviewers are actually saying that they quite like the technology. There were a few changes that they asked us to make, one of which was to have some prompting so that there was some sort of moderator role to prompt discussions, and that's something we're looking at for this pilot. Once the discussions happened, we're not asking them to reach consensus, just talk through discrepancies. They go back, update their ranking list until they're comfortable, and submit the final ranking to CIHR. So once that's submitted, each application has five ranks, a consolidated rank, and a standard deviation. That's the information that will be used to determine whether or not you're asked to submit an application to Stage 2. Stage 2 review process, basically the same, different criteria. Yeah, use your mic, please.
Yeah. This ranking business, to me, relies on the fact that each reviewer has a large enough sample
Yes. So
that it's representative. Otherwise, if you have five applications, it's useless. Now, it says here 15 to 20. Earlier, you mentioned 10 to 15. It makes a huge difference if it's 10 or 20, because 10 is a very poor sample, and 20 might be a slightly better sample.
Yes, so sorry, it is 15 to 20 for stage 1. I think there is some debate about whether or not 20 is too many for stage 2. So it is 15 to 20 for stage 1. We do know, though, in some areas of research, it will be challenging for a researcher to have 15 to 20 applications. And we're looking at a way to mathematically adjust for that ranking using a couple of different pieces of information if that occurs, if we have fewer reviewers for application. Do you want to talk about that at all, Paul?
No, I think you covered it pretty well, but you can imagine that there are some highly specialized areas of research where it might be hard to find 15 suitable applications for that reviewer, yet you need reviewing capacity in that area. When the numbers get smaller, one can start looking at the absolute scores to understand how that application may have ranked in a larger group, and we're doing different kinds of simulations and things now to come up with a good way to do that.
Thanks, Paul. Yes?
In that context, is it going to be only Canadian reviewers or international?
We are recruiting some international reviewers. It'll depend on the field of research. So we're trying to match the most appropriate reviewers to the application. That's what we're striving for. So a couple of questions at the back. Can you use your mic, please?
Thanks very much. I kind of want to make a comment about how we all know you're going to have problems finding enough reviewers, but that's actually not my question. Maybe we can come back to that later. You said that when there are discrepancies between the reviewers, there's this opportunity for the reviewers to talk. And I want to know if you mean talk, or are they going to have a conversation in text online. Can you talk a little bit about how it's actually done?
Yeah, it's an asynchronous discussion in text online, and we have piloted it twice now with two different competitions. So it's very user-friendly, interactive. You basically click on the application once your review is submitted. You go to you're brought to the discussion space where you can see the names of the other four reviewers, their ratings for each of the criterion, as well as the comments. So reviewers are asked to put strengths and weaknesses for each of the criterion. You're able to see those and focus specific discussions to specific reviewers or generally, or send questions to CIHR if required. So the technology is similar to what you would see in some of the social media kind of chat space, but as user-friendly as we could possibly make it.
And sorry, just one follow-up. Will you know the identity of the other reviewers, or is
Absolutely.
That anonymous? Okay, thanks.
Yeah. And you won't be able to see the reviews until you submit your own. So we do have your initial review submitted. There's another question.
But Jen, just to clarify that, once you've submitted your own, you still have the opportunity to change that once you've had this chat and seen the other reviews. So the initial submission gets you into that space, but then there's a final submission afterward.
Question at the back?
Yeah, sorry, just to clarify. So after stage one, when we get our result, we get the ranking.
Yes.
We will get our ranking.
Yes.
Okay. And the same reviewers of stage one that will review our stage two application?
Not necessarily. Okay. So there might be some common reviewers, but not necessarily, because we are moving from more applications in stage one to fewer in stage two. So there's some readjustment and some new reviewers will be introduced. So the same process happens in stage two. Again, you've got five rankings, a consolidated ranking and a standard deviation, and that's what determines whether or not the application is funded without further discussion, or whether it goes to final committee for discussion, or isn't funded. So that's basically the process. There is a peer reviewer guide that will be released around the time the application is available that does document it in more detail. And it gives some examples of what some of the screens look like in the system. So I'm going to move on. Yeah?
Sorry, this may have been on the timeline you had on an earlier slide, but if there's unanimity and you're funded after the second phase, are you notified at that time or only
no,
after
you're all,
phase
every,
two?
So everybody who is funded will be notified at the same time. And as all of you should be aware, we're managing the first foundation scheme pilot and the transitional OGP as one budget envelope. So the funding decisions for the transitional OGP are about the same time as well. Yes?
Thanks. Can we have access to that peer review guide?
Yes, once it's available.
And when do you think you will release that?
The timing will be around the same time that the application is available, so end of June.
Okay.
Okay, it'll be available on the website. So I'll move on to for clarification, some of the roles. So the terms are very different in foundation scheme from what you're used to at CHR. We're talking about program leaders and program experts. So we're not talking about NPIs or co-PIs or co-ops in this competition. Program leader is responsible for the overall direction of the research, and they're identified in ResearchNet at registration. You cannot change them after registration, though, so be aware of that. You can have more than one program leader, but you will see as we go through the different parts of the application, you need to demonstrate a history, a track record of managing programs together. So it's not two separate people with track record and high caliber that come together for the first time to submit this application. They will be assessed based on their track record of working, of managing a program of research together. Because you can have more than one program leader, we are asking you to identify an administrative coordinator. There's no difference from our perspective between the administrative coordinator and any other program leader. It's just the person who is the contact that will end up flowing the specific information through. Program experts are people that the program leader decides to bring to the table to make sure that there is the necessary expertise, experience, and resources to complete the research. They participate or contribute to the research program but don't direct it, and they will likely change over the course of the program of research. So the program experts that are named in the first application can and probably will evolve over the seven-year period. Yeah.
So just to confirm, if you are a program leader applying individually, you are also the administrative coordinator?
Yes.
And if there is a co-leader, one of you is designated?
Exactly. Thank you. Yeah.
So as I understand, you can only be a program leader on one application.
Yes.
Can you be program expert on multiple applications?
Through the transition period, yes. And we'll look at that after the transition period. Right now, we can't exclude you because nobody knows who the program leaders will be at the end of the competition. Yeah.
So what's the interest of having two program leaders? Because it will cut off the grants of... I mean, if you're two leaders, then neither of you can apply to other funding grants.
So I think this is intended for people who truly do co-manage a program of research and have a track record of doing that. And we do know in some fields that we support at CHR that that is common. So certainly they can come in as a group of or a set of program leaders. We're trying not to call them teams because that's confusing for people. it might make sense for an applicant to come in as a program leader and another applicant to come in as a different program leader and for them to collaborate together. If that's the way that their research works, that works as well. It should have, there is some flexibility in it. It really becomes a decision of the applicant. Yeah.
For new investigators, I understand that there'll be only one program leader because they're new investigators, the way I see it. And the other question is, I understand it's an operating grant, right?
Sorry?
It's an operating grant.
It is an operating grant.
Okay.
Yes.
Do you want to address the issue about whether new investigators can be more than one leader?
There is no specific rule that says a new investigator can't come in or two new investigators can't come in together. But they will have to demonstrate a track record of working together.
In practical terms, we probably won't get many applications like that.
Yeah.
So the old co-applicant are called expert.
Sorry?
A co-applicant in the past now is called expert.
So it's, I wouldn't try and draw the parallels too much because there are some differences about a program expert. If you go online, there's a few more details about what we mean by program experts. The program expert, I think if you think about the terms that we have today, could have been a collaborator, could have been a co-applicant, may have been a co-PI, depending on how the researcher worked.
It's called mix in one batch.
Yes. Question at the back?
Just to clarify, as you've exercised some control on who's eligible to apply to this first competition, if, let's say, as a program leader, I invite a current co-applicant who's not eligible for this competition to be a program expert on my grant, would that disqualify him from being a program leader in the next competition?
No. Is there a question over here?
Sorry. Does the person who's the admin coordinator have to stay the admin coordinator for 7 years?
Not necessarily.
So it could switch.
Okay. It can switch. Question at the back?
Yes. If there is two program leader, one being a new researcher and one being a more experienced researcher, I'll get the application judged. Is it judged as an application that's been sent from somebody with experience or as a new application? Or
it would not be considered a new investigator application.
Okay.
Yeah.
What information cannot be changed after the registration process? Let's say you put down, you want to be the program, a series of program expert. Can you change the program expert name after the registration?
There's no program expert named in the registration. Okay. It's just the program leader.
Okay, all right.
But that cannot change after the registration. So you can't come in as one program leader and add a second program leader after registration. It's because it has to be what was submitted for the registration.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Program experts can be international scientists?
Yes. Okay, I'll keep going. A lot of people have really asked us to define a little bit better what we mean by a program leader, and I think as we go through the application requirements, you'll see a little bit more of what we're talking about. But from our perspective, program leaders are widely recognized in their field and community of demonstrating a history of influential roles. They have ability to establish, resource, and direct major projects. They have significantly advanced knowledge and or its translation into improved healthcare, health systems, or health outcomes. They've engaged, trained, and or launched the career paths of promising individuals. They can demonstrate an outstanding level of research output, and their previous work has generated high-quality research outputs. And that's really the caliber of researcher that we're looking for in this program. One thing that gets a little bit confusing when we talk about these things is applicants will be evaluated based on their career stage and their area of research. So the metrics for leadership, for example, might be different from one field to another and will be different from one career stage to another. And we're asking reviewers to apply that judgment when they're doing their reviews. So stage one application. Has anybody looked at the stage one application requirements that are available on the website? That's it? So I encourage you to go take a look at them after this session. We're going to walk through them, but I do encourage you to look at them. Stage one focuses on the caliber of the applicant and the vision of the program, but you'll see most of it is based on the caliber of the applicant. Leadership, about half a page. Significance of contributions, about half a page. Productivity, about half a page. Vision, about one page. It's not a long application. Summary is a page. So we're also asking you to attach a CV. And I'm going to go through each one. This is pretty small text on the slide because we had lots to say about CV. Oh, sorry. A couple questions, yeah?
Yes. If there are multiple leaders,
yes,
it becomes very difficult to fit everything you said in one page because, I mean, you're talking now about two or three individuals, and you have to take your whole life history and your whole productivity and your leadership and everything. It's still one page. And,
so remember, when leaders come in as more than one program leader, what we are asking for is their track record of working together. So we don't expect to see three individual track records. We expect to see a summary of those people working together.
Yeah, but I mean, you talk about leadership. I mean, they're working together. They're not one person. They're two individuals. They do different things, but they're working together. And you still have to demonstrate their leadership, their mentorship, their all of these things in a very restricted space. I mean, have you thought about that?
We have thought about it, and it's definitely something that we'll monitor through the first pilot. So for every pilot that we do, we survey the applicants after the application is submitted, we survey the reviewers after they've submitted their review, and we survey the applicants after they receive their decision. And those are the kinds of questions we will be asking the applicants. But for the first pilot, the space is the same for both.
I have to tell you that this is one thing that makes me hesitate, and it's very unfortunate that page limitation actually creates this problem. It makes me and my collaborator hesitate as to whether we will do this.
Have you tried to fill it out together?
No, but I know what you can put in one page, you know.
Okay. So I think I'll take that back. Certainly there's still a few things that we're working through on the different applications. So I'll take it back and we'll take a look at it again. We have had some people try and do it as co-program leaders, and they were able to fill out the application. I think it may depend a little bit on the field of research, though.
You can always fit everything in one page, in one sentence, in anything you can fit. The question is it going to be a fair review? Because you can't fit as much about, you know, two or three people.
Right. Any other questions before I go on? So we'll go through each. So the program CV, and if there is multiple program leaders, each leader can submit their own CV. Yes?
We expect to get all the information through the common CV, including the publications. It's an idiotic scheme in the common CV that's impossible to read and impossible to fill out, or are we allowed, as it was until now, to append a Word document with the publications?
So the good news is, as of a week ago, there's new functionality available in CV that allows you to use a reference manager to put in your publications into CV. We have heard from the researchers that tested it that it works well. There's quite a few different reference managers that it supports. I don't think all of them are supported, but most of the popular ones are. So we are asking you for this competition to fill in the publications.
This new functionality, does it allow to indicate if the first author is a member of your lab and under your supervision, and if you were a co-senior author or not?
It does. So it allows you to indicate the status of your publication and different roles on the publication. I don't know how much detail it allows, so I can follow up on that.
Well, this is absolutely key. If you engage in collaborative research, you can't always be last and first. But you do split that. Your student becomes first, you second last as a co-senior author, and sometimes your student is co-first author and you are the last or the second last. This for review is extremely important, and it was not available in the CCV as it was in the past, which is ridiculous that you make us jump such hoops and then you actually get less useful information on top. It's impossible to read the scheme. I have been a reviewer many times. It's impossible to read it without getting a headache. Has that changed?
So the reviewer output does look a lot better. And it is a new PDF that we're using for this competition. We will follow up on this. I know there is a place for roles on the publication. Like I said, I don't know how much detail you're allowed to put in there, so we'll follow up on that. But I hear your point.
It's important to point out that Common CV is a different enterprise from CIHR, so we don't have they don't listen to CIHR's requests anywhere near 100% of the time. So we recognize the issues. We're trying to do our best to resolve them. I think the three councils are working together better to get CCV to be more responsive, since we are the major users. But you know, we recognize it ain't perfect.
But we hold you responsible because you went that way.
Fair enough.
Nothing prevents CIHR from requesting an attachment, right?
Sorry?
Nothing prevents CIHR from allowing an attachment on the CCV.
So I do think what is nice about this this scheme is the caliber of the applicant. You actually have in the application itself the ability to tell your story as an applicant and point to the relevant information in your CV as evidence, but you're able to give it context in the actual application. Question at the back?
Yeah, so I was just recently on a review panel, and so one of the administrators gave us some information, some which actually doesn't sound entirely consistent with everything you're telling us, but
okay.
What you're telling us is a little bit more reassuring, because she said actually at phase one that the team would be evaluated, and it's nice to hear you talking about applicant in the singular and not team. I should probably not give so much of a preamble because then I forget my question. But anyway, so what she did mention was that there had been some discussion of CIHR employing something similar to what NIH uses for the CV, which is this biosketch. Can you comment on that?
So we are using a biosketch-like CV for the project scheme. We're talking about actually testing it in the next transitional OGP. And based on what we've done so far, it does look quite a bit like the NIH biosketch, although they're changing their biosketch right now, so we're monitoring that as well. The CV for Foundation is a bit longer than a biosketch. It was modeled in a similar way, but we felt there was more information required because we were actually assessing the track record. So you'll see in the CV template, which is available on the website, what information we're requiring. It's all data fields that currently exist in the CV, though. So if you have a CV, you'll be able to port that information in. So just a couple points on CV. We're asking you to make sure you customize it to reflect the focus of Foundation Scheme. You'll see that we have put in limits of information in the different fields in the CV. What we don't want is a really, really long CV. We want to manage the size, but we want you to be able to identify the most important information to support your application. And it really is about evidence for your application. We're wanting to make sure that you include recognitions, achievements, and rewards obtained that would be relevant to the program of research. And the research history should include peer-reviewed and non-peer-reviewed grants and salary awards and contracts that are relevant to this program of research. There is just a little point here, which I hate to say this because it bugs me that the word error is used, because it's not really an error, it's just that information is missing. You'll see there's some mandatory fields in the CV for Foundation Scheme that aren't mandatory in our current template for the academic CV. When the CV gets loaded up in the new template, if you're missing information, you'll get an error message. Just the error means you just haven't completed that information and you need to fill it in. We're hoping we can change error to missing information because people are getting confused. It's not an error, it's just the information's not available because you've never put it in through another mechanism. The one thing that we are asking for, though, is your publications go into the CV directly, so no attachments. So please make sure you allow enough time, if you haven't done that yet for your CV, that you have enough time to actually complete your CV. Okay. Any other comments, questions on the CV? So if you remember the application itself, we have basically three sections, the first section being a summary. So this is about a page. We do use characters in our system, but our characters translate to pages. We have heard from some researchers who are using fairly old browsers that sometimes the character limits don't match, so just be aware of that. We're trying to make sure that we're as flexible as we can, but sometimes you might be off a little bit. What the summary is supposed to do is reflect the overall focus of your research career, in the nature of your experience and expertise, important collaborations you've established that are going to make this program successful, and the vision and direction of your research program. It's a summary. It is the information that we will use to do our reviewer matching. So that's important to remember that that's part of why we need the summary. It's also what we keep as a record of a summary of your program of research. You will be able to update some of that in Stage 2 because your summary will be more likely on your program of research in Stage 2. This summary is really about the caliber. That's what reviewers are assessing, with a little bit about the program of research. Leadership, you've got about half a page, 1750 characters. What we're asking you to do is show, it's basically to tell your story of leadership, which is what we're encouraging people to do. We want to understand your reputation in your field, how you've advanced directions in your field, translated knowledge into practice, how you've built networks and communities, examples of how you've directed large research programs or large sets of projects in the past. New and early career investigators may show leadership in different ways than established research investigators. And again, I firmly believe that our reviewers are actually very good at distinguishing what their expectations are for new investigators versus seasoned investigators. So they will be asked to adjust based on career stage. And what you need to make sure you do is point to the examples in your CV. So your CV is the evidence. You don't need to repeat your CV in the application, but you need to refer to the pieces of the CV. What reviewers will be asked to do is basically answer two questions. One is the applicant widely recognized in their field, demonstrating a history of holding influential roles, inspiring others, mobilizing communities, and advancing the direction of a field? And has the applicant demonstrated the ability to successfully establish, resource, and lead or direct a program of research? So that's basically what we're asking reviewers to assess. There will be a set of interpretation guidelines for reviewers that get into a little bit more detail in terms of what we're looking for under this criterion, and that will be available as an appendix to the reviewer guide, which will be available when the application is available. Any questions on leadership? Yep.
How will the reviewers evaluate new investigators? Because those two questions that you ask are more fitting to senior investigators.
So I do think, and I'm sure some of you in the room can give examples of influence in your field. I think most of the new investigators that have actually come into the system can tell a story about their impact and what they've done in the field, and that's what we're looking for. So the story might not be as extensive as a senior investigator story, but we are looking for very high caliber new investigators in this program. So I do, the one thing I would say, and I don't know if Paul wants to comment on this, is I don't think this program is for every new investigator. There are some new investigators that are probably better suited to the project scheme. This is new investigators that really are set up to manage a program of research and can demonstrate that they're ready for that. Do you want to comment on that? Yeah.
So you had mentioned that there'll be distinctions between career levels, different career levels, and so it was clear that new investigator was one such level. How fine a gradation are we talking about? Is the associate versus full professor level something like that will be considered?
So we're asking reviewers to consider career stage, and so there is information about their career stage in the application. So in addition, and you'll see this in the application requirements, in addition to the content of your application, there's some basic statistical information we're asking about the applicant. So that information will be provided to the reviewers.
If I can add, though, this is going to be at the discretion of reviewers. Reviewers will be instructed to take career stage into account. So what that would mean to me is that someone who's been a PI for 10 years is not likely to have as long of a track record of leadership as someone who's been a PI for 25 years. Whether someone's an associate professor or a full professor, I don't think it'll be strictly graded like that.
Okay, so I'll go on. Yeah.
I don't know how this one's going to go over, but we're talking about seven-year grants here?
Yes,
and I guess
except
it was
for new investigators, which are five.
It was just Dr. Lasko referencing someone who's 25 years in the business. I'm not sure I'm a fan of someone who's been around that long getting seven more years of funding. Is there any discussion about that? About if someone's looking like they're toward, even though they might have a great track record, you know, they're sort of approaching retirement.
So I think that's where the articulation of the program is important. So the vision in stage one and then the details around the program of research, they need to demonstrate that they do have 7 years' worth of a program of research to still lead.
I can just say there has been a lot of discussion about that, and I think there will be more discussion about that. It's interesting, though, but presently for five-year grants, we have a process in place of a midterm review after 3 years. And we could not find an example of anybody who ever didn't pass that review. And, in fact, the procedures for how that review is conducted are not all that clear. So we discussed quite a while having something like that for these seven-year grants, but then realizing what we have in place is not actually working. But once you start to make that more rigorous, then you haven't given a seven-year grant anymore. It's become a three-and-a-half-year grant or whatever. So I think discussions are underway. We hear your point, but for the moment we've decided to go with the seven-year grants for everyone except new investigators.
Okay. So second section is about significance of contributions. So this is really about impact. So the applicants are asked to put information in the application about the tangible benefits and positive influence on health and health research, significant contributions to advancing knowledge or its translation, mentorship and training, and again, contributions of new and early investigators may be different from those of established ones. And again, we're asking you to point to relevant portions of your CV. What reviewers are being asked to think about when they're doing their review is, has the applicant significantly advanced knowledge and/or its translation into improved health care, health systems, and/or health outcomes? And has the applicant engaged, trained, or launched the career paths of promising individuals in research and/or other health-related and non-academic fields? So again, if there's more than one program leader, it's their ability to do this together. So the contribution should be together as a set of program leaders. Productivity. So again, we're looking at focus on the quality and quantity of research outputs to demonstrate an exceptionally high level of research outputs compared to investigators in a similar field at a similar career stage. Again, it's based on career stage, though. And again, we'd ask you to point to relevant examples in your CV, and there are quite a few spots in the CV to put this kind of information. So what we're asking reviewers to look at is, has the applicant demonstrated an outstanding level of research outputs based on prior work, and has the applicant's previous work generated high-quality research outputs? So there's a volume question and a quality question. Any questions on this one? And that's the caliber piece. So you would have noticed that each of those is worth 25% in the rating process. The last piece is the vision and program direction. There is approximately a page for this. We're asking the applicant to articulate a compelling vision and direction for the research program, include the goal, overall objectives, expected outputs and contributions, articulate the program direction for the full duration of the grant. And remember, we're looking for vision here. It should be forward-looking, creative, and appropriately ambitious. What we're asking reviewers is, are the vision, goal, and overall objectives and potential contributions of the proposed program of research well-defined and well-articulated in the context of a logical career progression for program leaders? Is the vision forward-looking, creative, and appropriately ambitious? And does the vision aim to significantly advance knowledge and or its translation to improve healthcare, health systems, and or health outcomes?
Sorry, can I ask a question? I agree that someone who's proposing a seven-year program should be ambitious. That's actually been a problem on project grants, as we know them today, people being called overly ambitious. So presumably there's a fine line between being appropriately ambitious and overly ambitious. So
yes.
How are reviewers being told to define that line?
So I think, again, this is an area where we are relying on the expertise of the reviewers to recognize the appropriate level of ambition in the particular field.
I think reviewers have to be judging whether or not the goals of a project are reasonably achievable given the budget and given the duration. So when someone's criticized as being overly ambitious, it usually means they need five times as many FTEs in 24 years to do the project, right? So again, it will be a function of the budget, and these will have a fixed term. So if you're proposing research that's totally out of line with that, then you'll be criticized.
So just a note on stage one. So there is quite a bit of information already available for applicants. The funding opportunity is there. The application requirements, where most of this information I went through, is summarized or online. There is the CV, role definitions, eligibility criteria, a whole set of questions and answers. And most of the questions that you asked today are actually in that set of questions and answers. And then there are a few things that will come out when the application is available. So the applicant training module, the budget module overview, not the specific module, but an overview of that. And there will be a number of WebEx sessions in July, August, and September. Reviewers will get material as well. Peer review manual, as I had said, interpretation guidelines, which are part of that manual. There'll be specific training modules for reviewers in the fall and a set of questions and answers specifically for reviewers. Any questions on stage one? Yeah?
I guess it's more of a general question, but in terms of the questions that the reviewers are answering about the applications, and granted this is the Canadian Institutes for Health Research, they're very much focused on translational outcomes, healthcare delivery. For a basic researcher, in many cases, those answers will be no contribution or minimal contribution. How is that going to impact the application of an outstanding research proposal?
The goal of the program is to support research in all areas. It has the same breadth as the open operating grant competition. And at present, about 70% or so of open operating grants go to people doing fundamental, what we call pillar one type research. I don't think it's ever a good idea in an application to say no contribution. You probably do present your work at meetings, your thing you work on, even I work on fruit flies, but my gene might have a human orthologue that's been implicated in something, and I'll gain fundamental knowledge about using the fruit fly, I'll gain fundamental knowledge about that. So those are all valid answers to those kinds of questions.
I'm more concerned about the reviewers who may not have been part of the CIHR process in the past, essentially being asked a very pointed question about contributions to healthcare delivery.
I think most reviewers in the foundation scheme will be people who have been in the CIHR process in the past, and will be able to understand that there are different expectations in different fields.
Any other? Yeah.
Referencing the table that you put up, will the interpretation guidelines and the manual be available for applicants as well?
They will be available on the website.
On the website. Okay, great.
So I'll go on to stage two. Stage two, similar structured application focused on different criteria. You'll notice the caliber is a little bit in the quality and of the expertise and experience, but we have already assessed the caliber of the program leader in stage one. So in stage two, we're looking at the quality of the program, the concept, the approach, the quality of the expertise, so expertise, mentorship and training, quality of the support and environment, and the budget. We are asking in the registration that you give a notional budget amount just to give us a sense of the size of your program. It does not have to be exactly the same when you get to stage two because you'll have refined your thinking on it, so we're not expecting that to necessarily stay the same. Reviewers will be asked to do their scientific review and then provide comment on budget once they're completed that. We have been exploring with whether or not it's technologically feasible to not even show the reviewers the budget until they've done their scientific review. That was certainly a suggestion that came out from a number of our university delegates. And that's something we're just not sure if we can manage on a technical side, but we're looking into it. So I'm not going to go through these criteria in detail today. I am going to talk about budget a little bit, but the same information that I presented for Stage 1 is available in the application guidelines for Stage 2. So on budget, because there's lots of questions that we get about budget, in the application requirements, you'll see that there are basically three things we're asking for. So the applicants will be asked to provide information regarding their budget request to support the proposed program of research, the total amount requested, and the amount requested per annum, and I'll talk about that in a second. They're going to need to demonstrate, or you will need to demonstrate, that the amount requested is appropriate to support your program of research, making sure to highlight funding history and any other sources of your CHR funding history and any other sources of funding as appropriate. So we are looking for past information to help justify your future budget for your program of research. If the two are basically the same, it's an easier discussion for reviewers. If an applicant is asking for more than what they've historically managed, they need to justify it to their reviewers. And that's who you need to convince that it's appropriate and that it's an amount that you're able to manage. Like I said, it won't be factored into the scientific assessment. And the two questions we're asking reviewers to answer are, is it appropriate to support the program of research? Is it realistic? And is it well justified? So there will be information, there is information that we're requesting in the CV about your funding history. There'll be likely more information that we're requesting on your funding history in the application itself, because some of the information we're looking for isn't currently a data field that exists in CV, so it'll end up in the application itself, and that will be provided to reviewers when they look at the budget. We're looking at a modular budget approach for the foundation scheme. We did just pilot a modular budget approach for the synthesis pilot. We're going to ask, as I said, the funding. What we're asking for is the total amount requested for the 5 or 7 year period, and then we will divide it evenly across the 7 years. You will have an opportunity, though, to ask for that profile to be changed if it needs to be changed. So we're going to assume it's the same amount for each year, but you have the opportunity, once you're successful, to actually change the profile of funding. And where we think that that's important is for new investigators, because there might be some sort of ramp up that they're looking for. Yep.
I actually had a question about the last slide in terms of justifying the budget. So obviously, if you have a certain track record of funding, you can say, I've had this amount, I need that amount. So let's just hypothetically speaking, and this really is a hypothetical, say that you have current funding from CIHR for $400,000. And now you ask for $500,000. Can an explanation be as follows? The committees approved me for the equivalent of $500,000, and then CIHR cut 20%. Therefore, I really am running a program that costs $500,000, but I've only been given $400,000 to do the work. So, or will that sound like griping?
I would encourage you to put more than that as a justification, but we do recognize the environment that we've been over the last few years.
Actually, and along those lines, we do run on these budgets established after the 20% cut. Will there be an additional 20% cut once these go through, essentially on top of the previous cuts?
So what we are striving for in the foundation scheme is not to do across-the-board cuts. So we're striving to do cuts within, if required, within the grant application itself, but not across-the-board cut the way that we've actually done it in the past. But we are encouraging people to be realistic and really think about your budget request in the context of what you have historically managed. And we are expecting that very seasoned researchers who have always gone out and got additional funding to supplement their research will continue to do that. Yep.
What will be the guidelines for equipment?
So let me go through the template, because I don't have a good answer for you yet, but we're still working on that one. So this is a little bit small, but it gives you an example of the modular budget. It is still draft. Other than the university delegates, you're the first to see it, so it might not look exactly like this when we're done. It does say draft on it. We're asking you for the total amount, We're asking you for specific amounts that are total for the 7-year period or 5-year period for research staff, mentorship and training, consumables, non-consumables, conference travel and knowledge translation, and that category will probably change, the name will probably change, and a spot for any additional items that can't get included in those categories. So the total for the 7 years, the system will flag if your totals don't match, and we're asking you to round to the nearest 1,000 at the detail level and the nearest 10,000 at the top. So it is different from the way we have asked for budgets in the past. It's an estimate, a forecast of the budget for your program of research. There is some detail on this slide around what we're including, and when we have the information package on budgets, there'll be more detail here. In terms of non-consumables equipment, we do recognize that we have certain programs within CHR that have slightly different rules on equipment. We are straightening that out, so the rules around equipment will be clear when we actually send out the package. Yeah.
So my question regarding budget. So if budget is not just well justified from point of view of CHR, so will you expect to cut or suggest to remove particular portion of the budget, or you will look in general as not justifiable budget and you just decline this grant?
No, it won't be declined because of budget, but adjustments will likely be made as part of the funding decision. So we will ask the 5 reviewers to comment on the budget, and there will be a separate process where we're actually looking at the detailed budgets, and it'll likely be a subgroup of our final stage committee that's involved in that separate process. Yeah.
I'm still very confused as to the budget. There are applications on right now where we know the answer on the 4th of July, right? So do we assume they're accepted? We don't know. Right? And so when you ask us to introduce new innovative research, that would require a budget different than what we already have. So I don't understand how you expect us to get new research and yet tell us only use the budget you already have.
So I don't think that's what I'm saying. I do think if you're making a case in your application for a program of research that adds things over and above what you have done historically, if you can justify that to your 5 reviewers, that's fine. We're not putting any limits on it. Anything that is way above what you have historically managed over the last, say, 5 to 10 years will get extra scrutiny, though. So that's, if you can justify it, there's no specific cap, but it will have extra scrutiny if it's different from what you've historically managed. Yeah.
Your historical average, does it include only CIHR funding, or does it also include NIH or things like that?
So we're asking you to include CIHR and non-CIHR funding, but we are expecting that you will continue to go and look for other sources of funding. So what we're not expecting to see is for a seasoned researcher to consolidate any funding they've ever received and submitted in this particular application. If you've been funded by CHR for over a long period of time and you've had a funding history with us, that's the funding history that we will use as your baseline.
If I can just add to that, there's not just additional funding from other agencies like NIH, but there's also strategic funding. So if you hold a foundation scheme, you're still perfectly capable to go access some RFA that comes out of the Personalized Medicine Initiative from CIHR. You're still eligible to apply for those.
Yeah.
For a new investigator who doesn't have any history with CIHR, can you provide any guidance for what's an appropriate scope to, say, start your foundation? And are you looking to start on a scope that's similar to the projects, or are you looking to start on a more broader scope of your whole research plan? Or can you just give a little bit of guidance about what's appropriate? For brand new investigators.
So this is where I'd actually encourage you to talk to people within your faculty that you're potentially using as mentors today for some guidance, because those are the kinds of people that will be reviewing the applications. If you have other funding history, as many of you do as new investigators, that is information that will be used as part of it. I think you need to be realistic about what you can convince peer reviewers that you're able to manage that's appropriate for your program of research.
Maybe to put some context on this without getting too specific, because different individuals are in different situations, but there are some new investigators that end up with two grants in the OGP now. There are very few who end up with more than two in the OGP, and it's pretty highly selective to end up with two. So you have to think about whether you have a research program and a track record that would support, you know, the equivalent of two, or whether it's more prudent to go in with a program that would be the equivalent of one.
Okay. Any other questions? Yeah?
This is just a very basic question. So in the registration, they ask for a single budget number, yeah. So that should be the seven-year budget
yes,
number total for 7 years.
Yes, or 5 years if you're an investigator. Okay. Yes. Okay, so that's actually all I
sorry, sorry, I'm sorry, just to clarify, the seven-year budget, so the total amount over 7 years?
Yes.
Okay, that wasn't clear.
It's not clear
before.
On the registration?
No.
Okay, we'll make sure.
I think we're just accustomed to putting in an annual budget, so.
Okay, we'll make sure it's clear. We don't want to underestimate things.
You probably have some kind of a flag for anyone who's asking for under $50,000 a year because they didn't.
Yes.
Is the result of the first stage, will there be a ranking?
Yes.
And this ranking will be known to the applicant? And will it be known to the reviewer of the second stage, and will it play a role?
The information will be available to reviewers in the second stage, but we are asking them to focus on the application for second stage. So they're assessing different criteria, but we thought it was important for them to see the information on the caliber from the first stage. Applicants will receive their individual ranking, their consolidated ranking, and the institution will receive information about ranking as well for applicants that are at their institution.
And the reviews as well? Applicants?
Applicants will get the strengths and weaknesses from all five reviewers.
And will the reviewers of the second stage see these reviews as well or not?
I'm not positive where we've landed on that one. We have debated it a little bit because we want the reviewers to focus on stage two and not re-review for stage one. So I don't think we've actually closed that issue. It's likely that they won't have it, but I'd have to get back to you on that one.
And you realize it's a very critical question because if I end up at stage one, very close to the bottom, the question is, do I drop my application and go for a operating grant, or do I continue?
Right.
And so it's very important that we know,
that you know that
how much the influence of stage one is on stage two.
So we'll make sure that's clear when the final application materials get put out at the end of the month.
It's an important point that's been a complicated one to resolve because we want the phase two reviewers to do it independently of stage one. So we would want it to happen sometimes that somebody comes out at the bottom of near the bottom of stage one and nevertheless gets the grant. On the other hand, you know, do you really want to withhold relevant information from the second round of reviewers? So it's a complicated issue.
One thing I will say is stage three reviewers will have access to information from stage one and stage two. So they will, as part of the committee, have that information. Yes?
You already addressed the issue of applications for special program grants subsequent to receiving one of these things. Could you just go over succinctly the intersection of this program with operating grants? If I have a CIHR operating grant and I apply for this, am I allowed to continue to complete the CIHR operating grant? My understanding is I'm not allowed to apply for any more operating grants once I've received one of these. Is that correct?
So the OOGP is in its last normal competition right now, and there's one more transitional OOGP. The foundation pilot's running in parallel. So once you become a program leader, you won't be eligible to apply for future project scheme grants, which will get launched after the transitional OOGP. So that's one part of your question. What we will be doing is, once you have been successful as a foundation applicant, we will look at the budget that you're requesting, and your current OGP grants will get terminated and rolled into that program of research. So it becomes part of that. Yeah?
Following on that vein, but that depends on the fact that your other grants are on the same topic or not of your foundation grant. If you have a grant on one topic with one KPI, and then your foundation grant is on another topic, and
so I think that gets to the core of what we're really trying to fund through the foundation scheme. We're not funding a project. We're funding a program of research. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're asking you to articulate is your program of research. It's likely that your program of research includes multiple projects, and that's what we're asking you to sort of articulate going forward.
So what happens with the budget of my KPI, for example, if now I articulate my several current funding into a single project, so, or into a single program?
So from CHR's perspective, the funding goes to the NPI. So we have no information about how the funding flows beyond that. Mm-hmm. Every institution across the country has a slightly different way of managing it. Mm-hmm. So what we're working with is the NPI and the grant mm-hmm. holder.
It would seem, although it's not really CHR's business, I agree with Jen, I would think that the reasonable thing to do to our colleague who is a co-PI is to honor the terms of that co-PI agreement. So if you're giving a co-PI $50,000 a year out of one of your OGPs, it runs until 2017, and now you have a $400,000 foundation grant that subsumed that OGP. If it were me, I'd give the guy the $50,000 as agreed until 2017, but that'll be an individual decision for mm-hmm. each PI.
And you can answer it that way.
Yeah. I mean, those of us who have grants that ends in March are going to lose 3 months of funding. Mm-hmm. And how come the CHR has not thought about that?
So originally we had a six-month gap. We've managed to close it to three. What we have been doing is working with the institutions across the country to look at the individuals that are in that situation, and the institutions are working with us on their side to actually come up with strategies. So if you have specific concerns about that, we've been working with the VPRs and the presidents of the institutions, and I'd go through your research offices if you want to have specific conversations about your unique situation. Well, most institutions across the country are coming up with solutions. It's hard for me to comment specifically on McGill, but most institutions are looking at options for their researchers who are in that situation. Yep.
So what you're saying is researchers that currently hold an operating grant should include that budget in their CIHR Foundation project, because their current one is going to be closed and that money will be going back to CIHR.
So what I'm saying is you should come up with a budget that's appropriate for your program of research.
So if I can just maybe clarify. So yes, you should include the budgets of your other open operating grants that are not expiring now, because those will be, I don't like to say they'll be closed and the money go back to CHR. I say they'll be extended for a 7-year term, so maybe it'll only be a 4 or 5 year extension for those, and you'll not have to write renewals for those grants.
Okay, but if they don't include it, will CIHR automatically add it to their application? No. The researcher will have to ensure that they've included it.
It'll need to be in the requested budget. I think, and Jen, correct me if I'm wrong on this, I think we will not allow anybody to get a foundation grant that's smaller than the sum of their present research.
It'll get flagged. But there's no specific.
Yeah.
Sorry, question over here.
Yeah, so this is kind of along the same lines, but it's about the Partnership for Health System Improvement Grant. So since the application is after the Stage 1 application, my understanding is you can still apply because you haven't applied for Stage 2.
Yes.
But then what's the implications for that budget if you happen to get both, or for that whole grant?
Yeah, so if you are truly doing programmatic research, and that is a project that you would include in the program of research, I would include that in your application. What we're finding is a lot of the applications that we get into those kinds of programs are much more project-based researchers. So each situation is different. Robin wants to answer that.
Yeah, I think this is probably very good for the people who are used to getting FISI grants, because these relationships you have with knowledge users and with the partners in the program are hard to establish. They take a while. And so this is perfect, I think, for programmatic research.
is to have, typically this will be a series of things that you'll be doing with your partners, and I would include your budgets that you're using for your FISI grants in your application, and think big with your partners about the sort of program or series of projects you want to do.
Any other questions? Yeah?
Yeah, this relates to the timeline. Maybe you mentioned it in the first slide, but just to remind us. So the amount of time between the notification of stage one and our success or lack of it and the time to apply
for the transitional education?
For stage two, yeah.
So. Oh, for stage two?
Yeah.
So the notice of decision is December 1st, and then the application stage two deadline is February 5th.
Okay.
Okay. And there is time between the notice of decision for stage one and the registration for the transitional OGP. So if you aren't successful and do want to register for transitional OGP, there is time in there. Not a lot of time, but there is some time. Comment at the back?
Just to clarify again, so I describe my overall research program, no matter if it's funded or parts of it are funded by other research agencies, and then it would be my job in the budget justification to say, well, in year one and two, I still have funding from this and that, and but for year three, four, five, I would increase my budget or something like this.
So I think that's a story you need to tell to the reviewers.
Okay.
And if you can justify that, but we are expecting that you do continue to get funding from other sources.
So to be clear, okay. Your research program should include all the research that's being funded from CIHR operating grants. It would be your judgment call, I think, whether you necessarily want to include research that's funded by other agencies, because if you're planning to go and renew to those agencies, you may have issues with a perception of overlap on their part. So you will need to be, it'll be a judgment call for you on that, I think. I mean, if you want to try to get a larger foundation grant budget by putting that research in as well, or, for instance, you have a grant that's not renewable from some other agency, then it might be more appropriate to include it.
Yeah, I think the challenge with these is that your scenarios are very different and unique, and, mm-hmm. and the multiple different scenarios we've received questions on, it's hard for us to give one answer to say, absolutely, this is what you should do. Because we are allowing applicants who don't currently have a history of CIHR funding to come in as well. If someone's come in from another country and they've joined an institution here in Canada, they have a track record internationally, then yes, we would expect that they would put some of that information in their budget request. It really depends on your scenario. Okay. There was a question over here, and then I'll come to you. Yeah?
Yeah, so I guess...
Oh, I'm sorry.
You were
right behind you.
If you're eligible to the pilot foundation scheme at the next competition and do not succeed, will you be eligible later on to apply?
Yes.
And when would that be?
So you're actually eligible to go to the next foundation pilot. I think what we're saying to applicants is look at the results and look at what your reviewer comments were and make a decision whether or not you can build your track record in that period of time or refine your thinking on your program of research. If you can, then absolutely, you're eligible to go into the second pilot. And then once we get through these first two pilots, the eligibility is open as long as you've got the kind of track record we're looking for. Sorry, we'll go over here and then back to you. Yeah.
Could you clarify who is and who is not eligible for this pilot foundation scheme with respect to their current operating grants and when they end? I know that this has been a topic of discussion in the past, but I wanted to make sure.
You can do that? I don't have the dates in front of me.
So if you have an operating grant, an open source of funding from CIHR that ends October 1, 2014 to September 30th, 2015, you qualify for this fall's foundation scheme pilot. If you have an open source of funding from CIHR that ends October 1, 2015 to September 30th, 2016, you are eligible for the following fall, so the fall 2015 pilot. Or if you've never held CIHR funding or if you're a new investigator.
Yeah. It's CIHR open funding. You could
open
have held
funding.
Okay, one last question, and then I think we should probably pass it over to Robin. Oh, you're fine? Oh, you have some questions online? Okay.
So I have two questions from the Internet. One is, can you please repeat what is needed in the summary of the
registration, is it both caliber and program direction?
In the summary of the registration?
Yes.
It's a registration for stage one. So it's a summary of the caliber, leadership productivity contributions, and a bit on the vision for your program.
So both. And the other question, I think you've already answered, but if one applies for the foundation scheme in September, can they apply for the March transitional OOGP?
So you can apply for, if you're not successful at stage one, you can apply for the transitional OOGP. If you do put forward an application in stage two, then you cannot apply to the transitional OGP. So we're basically asking you to make a choice between those two competitions. All right. Oh, one last question.
Well, actually, it's about the, is it never held funding or is it do not currently hold funding?
Never held open funding.
Really? Okay. And do you
and to be honest, we used a 10-year window, so if it was 15 years ago, then we're making exceptions. If you have specific questions about your individual circumstances, email the roadmap email address, and we'll look up your file. We've done that for quite a few researchers.
Don't tell them if you had a grant 15 years ago.
And one other question. In terms of the stage one, the people in stage one that are going to go on, have you come up with calculations for numbers of people or percentages of people that are going to go on and be... go on to stage two?
So we've put a specific range in the funding opportunity of how many will fund at the end of the competition. And the range, yeah, I should have these numbers off the top of my head. I think it's from 150 or...
Maybe don't do them off the top of your head. There has been a published range, but it's rather a broad range. And the reason for that is that we're trying to coordinate this competition with that transitional OOGP competition, and there's a single budget envelope for the two. Now, we have no, once the registration process is complete and we know how many people registered, then we can start to say some things that are somewhat sensible about percentages. But right now, the number of applicants is somewhere between 42 and 800 plus, right? So it's really, we don't know what the denominator is. And if we really only got a couple hundred applicants, then the number of these that would be funded will be different from if we get 800 applicants. So until we know how many people have registered and have entered the process, it's very hard to say anything intelligent about numbers. Once we're past that point, which is soon, then we can start to narrow down these scenarios a lot better.
So the max that we would fund in foundation scheme is 250. So that'll be at the max. It's the lower end of the range that I can't remember. But it's a very broad range, and as Paul said, it does depend on the application pressure. And you'll notice in the transitional OGP, we've also got a range. We're not committing to a specific number in that competition. Okay, I will hand it over to... Oh, still hand up. Sorry.
Last question. Let's say you're unsuccessful to the stage one.
Yes.
Then you apply for the transitional operating grant.
Yes.
Are you still eligible for the stage two, the second pilot foundation scheme in the fall 2015?
If you go into the transitional OGP and you are successfully funded, then you're no longer eligible for the foundation pilots.
The second one? Okay.
As it stands now.
You would have to wait until the following year when it's open to everybody.
Okay. All right, I'll hand it over to Robin. Do you have Robin's presentation?
I just wanted to talk about a little bit the, could you help me with this?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, it's on there. Yeah, the most recent one. Yeah, so I just wanted to talk a little bit about, I'm the scientific director for the Institute for Health Services and Policy Research. So our particular community had not been doing all that well, relatively speaking. And so this change, this reform for us, represents an opportunity to modify some of the things that we are seeing in the first decade of our funding at CIHR, which I just wanted to show you what those issues were so that how many people here are either doing clinical health services or population health research? Okay. So probably it's important for you to know this because this is an issue that our community will need to address. And actually the foundation scheme represents an opportunity that will truly be valuable for us, and I think that it will be important that we get it right and also that that we can potentially overcome some of the problems we've been having. That one. That's it. Oh, dear. Okay. So here's a little bit of the story. So in the first 10 years, give or take, this is the NEOPA operating grants competition. You could see that 82% of the funding was for the foundation or biomedical scheme, and that 3% was for people in health services and policy research, 9% for clinical, and 6% for population health. So that means that the major share, essentially, is not in these other communities. And you can see also, if on the right-hand side, this little bar graph that indicates that in terms of nominated principal investigators is that that you know, the distribution's a little bit more equitable here, but we're still at only 7% for health services and policy research, 10% for population health of investigators being funded. So there's some issues about how we do things. One is that for our communities, that we tend to actually do project-specific kind of funding requests. And as a result, we don't often go back for asking for renewals. It's very unusual that we do that. So the majority of renewals of programs of research, they're not necessarily all programs of research, but this has been a phenomenon more in the biomedical community. So this is a bit of a new game for us, I'd have to say, is the concept of having programs of research that are funded in an ongoing way and a huge opportunity to do things differently than we have been doing it. The other issue that has arisen is that the actual duration of the grants that are requested essentially are particularly low for health services and policy research. And as a result, in terms of sustained funding, is that they are less likely to have sustained funding because they have to keep on coming back. So this is good news. Another issue that has come up is the whole issue of absolute rating. And this is where ranking will be hugely helpful, I think. So if you look at the bottom, is that with the triage score as of 2003 was 3.5, and you can see that the average rating, this is the average rating for grants in the clinical health services and population health communities, is the average rating is about 3.5. So that means on average, half of the grants are essentially being declared as being non-fundable or below the triage line. So even if there were money available, which there usually isn't, we only fund 20 to 22%, of funds over that period of time, is that that this community tends to be very different in the way it scores things. So now that we're pushed into now a ranking phenomenon, this is probably be very good because it's very hard to change this behavior we discover. You can actually get out your PR lines and actually go after it, and you can bump it a little bit. As you can see, in 2008, there was an attempt to try to bump up that behavior, but we're back to sort of using the middle of the scale thereafter. And as a result, in fact, the highest proportion of non-fundable projects are in the clinical health services and population health scheme. And I know, Jen, we had some discussion about non-fundability and a bar for non-fundability. I didn't know if you want to mention that for the foundation scheme. Would there be a phenomenon such as that?
I don't think so, because we're ranking. So, you know, in practical terms, it, you know, it'll depend upon the proportion that goes through each phase. But no, I don't think we'll have a triage bar in the same way, because it's not a panel, right? And so each reviewer will be giving a ranking. And so clearly, just mathematically, some of them will come out very low, but we won't have a triage bar in the same way, because it's not based on rating, it's based on ranking.
Yeah. Okay. So I think the good news about this is that the kind of issues that we've been having in the community will potentially disappear, and that this problem of actually having very few researchers, less than 19%, having sustained funding over 5 years will change. So all very good news, I think, with this new scheme. And in fact, I just wanted to, at this point, I think it's an issue of strategy. And so Joy Johnson, who worked with us on a boot camp that we had last year at McGill to try to address these issues with senior leadership in the research community, basically has come up with a number of scenarios. So she worked on the task force. I think this is kind of useful to think about because it really is all about strategy. So here's an example of a new investigator who has a modest research grant of $50,000 per year for 2 years, and she's decided she wants to apply for the foundation scheme, and she's going to be asking for roughly that amount of money going forward for her first 5 years of her program, and so that she can actually conduct her program research. This may be something a researcher who does qualitative research, or it could be someone who actually does database research and is using us to purchase databases and do analysis using that. But here's another example, and I think someone brought this up, of a situation where the investigator is completing a CHR-funded project where they have a grant of $100,000, but they're imagining that their program of research and the direction it's going in is going to actually ramp up, and so that they're going to be moving, doubling or tripling the amount of money they need to do their program research. And this is where you really have to think strategically, I think. And so this researcher decided that they would actually start ramping up their program of research using the project scheme. And then when that actually got kind of ramped up and was moving kind of successfully, is they might flip over to the foundation scheme. Because by then they will have already demonstrated, because they're imagining a very steep ramp up of what they want to get in terms of funding to do their vision of the future. So this is a slightly different strategy where they've taken the option of saying, I'm going to go project scheme, and then I'm going to come back and do the foundation scheme later. When you look at mid-career investigators, here's an example of an investigator who has consistently held CHR funding to the tune of about $150,000 a year, but they've never held it, has never had open CHR funding, and so therefore they're eligible to apply for the foundation scheme. This has all been through strategic funding opportunities. They decide to apply for, with a budget of $150,000 a year. If they're successful, they realize that as a program lead, they won't be eligible to apply for the project scheme to supplement that. They can apply for other strategic funding, other funding from other agencies, but they decide that this is they're in a sudden steady state. This is their program research. They're going to apply for the foundation scheme because then they can actually have 7 years of funding and really can get their act together and their program running. So this is kind of an exciting one. Here's a team scenario where you have two clinicians. They're mid-career researchers. They've worked together for the past 7 years on a number of multi-year project grants in the same thematic area, building a shared program of research. They've demonstrated shared leadership, and they have made significant contributions to their field. M is eligible for the 214 Foundation Scheme, but Dr. R is not. But they decide they are going to go ahead anyway because Dr. M is eligible and they can apply together. So here's an example where you have two people at different stages of eligibility, so they're able to apply together. Here's another example of two researchers working together, and this is another strategic decision you need to make, is they decided that they would be best put if they actually, as a team, one goes for the foundation scheme and therefore gets extended funding in there for 7 years, and they're still planning to work together, but they decide that that Dr. C here is going to be the program expert on that foundation scheme so they can continue to apply for project funding, thus giving them some degrees of freedom, some flexibility to embellish and amplify their program of research as they go forward. So they have 7 years of funding, plus they have the supplemental project scheme funding, and then Dr. C can come in and apply for foundation scheme at some point later or never. When it comes to senior investigators, here's an example of a senior investigator who's held a number of CHR grants over the past 20 years. Over the last 10, they've established a joint program of research with another senior scientist. In partnership, they would have made significant contributions and have a strong vision for a shared program of research. They plan to continue to do their work together, and so they plan to apply together for the foundation grant as program leaders. Should their application be successful, however, neither of them can apply for project scheme grants. They can apply for strategic funding, of course. They can apply to other agencies, but they will have to stick with this, the 7 years program research for the two of them. And then one last scenario is a senior investigator has held a number of CIHR grants. In his work, he's primarily a partner with another senior scientist. They plan to continue to work together, but agree that Dr. Y should apply for the foundation grant, and his research colleague will be named as program leader on this grant. The decision is made strategically so that Dr. Y's colleague can continue to apply for funding under the project scheme. So again, strategy being used here to say, where do we think we're going, and what's our best opportunity to do so? So I want to just stop there because we thought it was useful. People were really trying to get their head around what is best for me. And so we just put together some examples of these scenarios. Do you have any scenarios or questions that you have that you wonder about vis-a-vis the strategy of how you want to apply? Or any other questions? Yeah.
I guess I have a more of a budgetary question. If you are co-PI on a grant that's administered primarily at another site,
yeah,
then when you put in your own application, presumably you would name that other PI as an expert on the grant. It's only a small part of your research program. Would you include then in your budget the amount that you're getting from that other grant, or would you not include it and still continue to receive from the other site?
So you're named as the co-PI on that grant, and you're getting a small proportion of that.
Say 20%, yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question. Do you have an answer?
So it's hard to answer it across the board. I think you need to work with the other, the person that you're working with. So if they're applying for as a project leader and they're putting the budget for the full amount, then what we don't want is for people to be asking for the same money in two applications. So we're just asking you to think about your program and talk to the other applicant, or if they are applying as well, about those kinds of strategies.
Yes?
I just want to assure that the Canada Research Chair cannot be included in this.
A Canada Research Chair cannot apply, is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying the budget.
Research Chair... Much of the support is for salary, so that's irrelevant to this. If you do have a research grant from that chair that's substantial, it's a source of funding, and it should be reported. But it would be considered money that's external to CIHR, even though CIHR contributes to the chairs.
Okay, guys. So any last questions for Jen? Yes?
In terms of productivity, the requirement is pretty high. Eh? It says exceptional productivity, which can be highly influenced by your field of research. So maybe you say before I arrive at this meeting, but how will the review panel be formed? Because it can have a huge impact on your evaluation.
So every application will have five reviewers. So there's basically an individual panel for every application, if you want to look at it that way. It'll be matched based on the most appropriate expertise for that application. Because the College of Reviewers is still being implemented, we will use the information that we have available to us. Like the current committee structure that's still in place for the transitional OGP. So there will be reviewers that will help in the way that chairs and SOs do today. The chairs and SOs will help with the matching and will supplement that with other reviewers as well. But the aim is to have the most appropriate reviewers reviewing your application so that they have a sense of what is what kinds of leadership contributions and productivity are appropriate for your career stage and your field of research.
Yes?
In one of your slides, you had a scenario where there were two people, one who was eligible and yeah. one who wasn't.
Yeah.
And if they were both to be program leaders, is my understanding correct, then that they could both apply because one is eligible?
Okay, so this is where they were working together.
Yes.
One is eligible, one isn't.
Mm-hmm.
They want to continue working together,
yes.
and so they can apply together
okay.
because one is eligible.
Okay.
But they can't apply separately as two separate.
No,
okay. Good luck with your applications. Oh, yes, go ahead.
This is from a remote viewer. So she is a new investigator, and she wants to know what's the downside or the disadvantages of applying to the 2014 pilot?
Can I just answer that? My take on this is that the price of admission here is pretty low. You know, it's a structured review. It's very limited. You probably have written this up for your career awards or salary awards or so on. You'll have a great opportunity to get feedback through this exercise. And so if you're eligible, I would certainly take advantage of actually getting in stage one and sort of seeing what kind of response am I getting? Where do people think I am? So it's a wonderful time to get some feedback, and I would definitely go for it.
So I agree with Robin, but with the proviso that you have a strong track record, because this will be a pretty selective competition. The only other potential, I agree with Robin, and new investigators should be encouraged to apply for this, and it's not an enormous, laborious first-stage application. I guess the only possible downside, since that was the question, is if you anticipate your program is going to just ramp up at an incredible pace, having a five-year budget where you can't apply for other project grants could be perceived as a disadvantage, but I don't think very many people will fall into that category.
Yes.
One question that may be beyond the scope of this meeting today, but in terms of strategies, what's considered right now the most likely renewal rate for these 7 years down the line? What fraction will be renewed?
Yeah.
Well, but it does make a difference strategically, because you'll have your entire program come to an end if you don't renew, whereas if you do that.
It isn't an issue, a practical issue, until something like 2020. So the reason there were some chuckles is that, many of us aren't thinking that far into the future. It's based on track record, right? So if you've gotten one of these and you're successful and you have a similar or better profile at the end of it as you had at the beginning, I think you should be pretty confident it'll be renewed. It's not like the project scheme where each project is being based on its own merits. You're basically starting from square one with each application. You are starting from, it's based on your track record. You're starting from something, provided that your track record, you've been productive through that period and you're still doing visionary, innovative, exciting research. That's what you're proposing for the next 7 years. It would seem that you should be confident you'll be able to get it renewed.
So I think the other pieces were, so the renewal process will happen before the foundation grant ends. So when you come in for a second foundation grant, we're asking you to come in at just before the end of, end of year five, so that if you'll have a decision and still have a year of funding if you're not successful to transition.
There's a question right here. Yes, and one back. Yeah.
Can two people apply together as program leaders, even if they are at different stages, as long as they can clearly demonstrate a record of working together on projects, working together on mentoring?
Yeah,
and as we answered before, though, if a new investigator comes in together with a senior investigator, it would not be considered a new investigator grant.
At the back.
I alluded to this at the beginning. I guess when I was in Ottawa a couple of weeks ago, when we were given information and then given the opportunity to ask some questions, we kept coming back to this concern about the College of Reviewers. How big is it going to be? Is there going to be enough expertise in that college? Some grants might be easy to find 15 people to do an initial evaluation because of it's a big field, a lot of experts in Canada and U.S. wherever, and others it might be more specialized. And so there's it seems clear that there's going to be some inequity in how different proposals are being evaluated. And I just, is there a go-no-go point? Everyone talks about the train having left the station, but once you actually have these proposals in, I wonder if sanity is actually going to ever rear its ugly head and say, this is just not going to work. We're going to disenfranchise too many people because there's going to be real inequity in how applications are being evaluated.
Can I just say something, because I'm sure Jen has 1,001 things to say in response to this.
is, you know, I've sat on review committees as well and chaired them, and there is inequity when you come in with something novel that isn't part and parcel of the experience of the review committee. And so I think that there is terrible inequity, especially for innovative areas that don't really quite fit, and you can see that people are not fitting any one committee, and so I don't think they are treated well. At least the aim of this initiative is to be application-centric in the review, and so the chances of actually being treated more equitably are far more greater, even from a theoretical basis, using this approach than using the current approach, for sure, unless you're very mainstream, meat and potatoes and that sort of thing, which by definition often means you're not at the cutting edge. So I do think that that's a challenge in any enterprise, and particularly the way that what we're moving from, and so this should theoretically be better. But I'm not sure that there will ever be the perfect scenario because, you know, you may be the one in the world who actually, the one person in the world that is actually doing this piece of work, and you don't really have any peers. And in my experience, the people who actually write grants so well is they write so that even if I'm not an expert in the area, I can understand what you're doing and be enthusiastic about it. You don't jargon me to death with stuff that I don't understand. And so I think that it will still be the skill of the writer, and I don't think that will change enormously. Jen, over to you.
So I know there's a few numbers that were thrown around on the college in terms of targets. So if you look at the number of reviewers we've accessed at CHR to support all of our program over the last 5 years, it's about 5,300 reviewers. We know that what we need to run foundation scheme and project scheme is actually very similar to the numbers that we use in a year for OOGP. There's not, it's the workload is distributed differently, but the number of reviewers is actually similar. We are conscious that in certain fields we have some challenges, and we're starting to work with some of the other funders internationally who experience the same challenges to try and get agreements to share reviewers across different countries. And we believe by having some of these remote processes, it'll actually be easier to recruit some of those international reviewers.
I can just add, I agree with everything I just heard. Just to add a couple more points, the number of applications to the foundation scheme, and the reason we're launching the foundation scheme first is that the application pressure is a lot lower for that than it is for the project scheme, and so therefore the number of reviewers that are necessary to support this is also lower. I don't think the questioner asked whether we're going to see the light and decide just not to do this competition. I don't think that would be a very popular decision with anybody. I mean, given this has been launched and people are going to invest effort into writing applications, I think you can be assured that this competition will happen. Now, what may happen is this is a pilot, and we will learn things going through this process that will be informative and that will lead probably to changes in details and specifics about how the next one is rolled out. But I don't want a rumor to spread that CIHR might be considering not doing this because we have launched the competition. We're committed to it.
That was more wishful thinking on my part. I didn't think that would actually happen.
I will get back to you on that if you get a foundation grant.
Yes.
So they mentioned that renewal for the 7-year foundation grants would happen in year 5. Does that mean if you're new and you have a 5-year grant, it would happen in year 3?
Do you want to clarify that, Jen?
Yeah, so I think it would probably be in year 4 in that case. We're still working through it. But the idea is what we don't want is for you to get a decision that you're not getting a second foundation grant and have no money left in your program of research. We do want enough time to transition.
Okay, so thank you very much. Oh, do you have a final words? Okay.
I would like to thank our speakers for sharing the current up-to-date information, and thank you for coming. So we will follow up with you with any additional information, and please send your questions to email that Jen indicates, as also please contact our Office of Sponsored Research, and we will help you to support through this application process. Thank you.
Before anybody, I just do have the attendance sheet, because I don't think it's made its way over. This
Yeah, it's important. Please put your name so we could follow up with McGill internal information, some guides, tips to our researchers. Thank you.